Kia ora, this program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Wellington Access Radio, make your voice heard.
Good morning and welcome to the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting on air. My name is Victoria. I'm an alcoholic and chairperson for today's meeting.
Good morning, Victoria.
Hi, everyone. Where are we? We open AA meetings with the Serenity Prayer, and I invite you to join me. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Right, so you are listening, like we mentioned, to the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting on air in Wellington, and this morning we have the Saturday Plymouth meeting with us, so we're very pleased that you can join us today. And meetings also start with a preamble, which I'll read now. So the Alcoholics Anonymous preamble is, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I'd like to ask Matt to please read how it works.
Or Dan even.
Or Dan.
Yeah. Thanks, Victoria. I'm Dan, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dan.
So this is chapter 5 from the big book, How It Works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose, in a general way, what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have, and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember, we deal with alcohol. Cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3. made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. Were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people, wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A. That we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C. That God could and would if he was sought.
Thanks, Dan. Now I'll ask Matt if he could please open the sharing.
Thanks. I am Matt. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Matt.
And it's great to be here for another meeting. I don't think I found it easy to say those words, that I was an alcoholic, and I certainly didn't say them or think them until I came into the rooms of AA. When I was drinking, I was in a state of denial. I was concerned about my drinking, but I never ever thought that my perception of an alcoholic was different to my perception of what I was. I definitely thought an alcoholic was someone who was homeless and drinking on the street, and the world had completely collapsed, and they were shouting at people who were walking by, and it was hard for me to think of myself as an alcoholic until I went into those rooms. And I certainly at first was feeling perhaps embarrassed and a little bit ashamed to call myself an alcoholic, and that was one of the barriers for me. But a few years down the line, I look back and I realise I never had a choice. There was never a moment where a turning point where I could have moved away from alcohol and from my addiction, right up to the point when I went into the rooms of AA. The booze got me from a very young age, from about 12 or 13, and I just went on a course, an unstoppable course, and I just loved it. It was the most magical thing to me, and it brought to me all the things that I admired. It was a sign of masculinity and machoism, and it brought a sense of brotherhood and camaraderie, and I loved pubs. I loved the atmosphere of the pub and the people in it. And the greatest mystery for me, I suppose, was why everybody didn't drink in a pub every night. I just didn't understand that. My ambitions as a young man changed completely when I found the pub. Travelling the world and doing all exciting things, at that point I just made the decision I wanted to stay in my local pub and get a job that would pay for me to drink in that pub and play snooker and pool 7 nights a week. And I was baffled that other people didn't want that life. But I surrounded myself with like-minded people. I drank with drinkers, and that normalised my drinking. And I drank from in pubs from the age of about 15 to to when I left the UK at about 35 years old, I was proud of the fact that I could walk into any pub in Yorkshire, in the city of Sheffield, at least on the south side, and I'd know people, men at the bar, you know, and we lorded over the world. We looked down on the normal people. We thought that they were lacking imagination and lacking an understanding of how to live your life, and it was delusions of grandeur, absolutely with no substance. You know, we'd look down on doctors and nurses and everyone, and we just created this world of a sense of supremacy over everyone, and it was completely unfounded. And I'd reject anyone who didn't drink like I drank. Just reject them. My ex-wife would introduce me to, another couple, and if he didn't get hammered on that first meeting, he was gone. I'd have nothing to do with them again. And that was how I lived my life. And I would drink straight from work, get the 8 to 10 pints on board, and then drive home, pick my daughter up from nursery, and get home and crack into the wine. And that was. Go to bed usually at the same time as my 2-year-old daughter, which was suited me. That was my life. Not much of a marriage, but that was the way I liked it. And in the end, I had to travel up the M1, and it was horrific traffic, and you get stuck in it. So it made obvious sense to me, especially on a Friday night, to have a few cans in there in case you got caught in the traffic. And then that became every night, just in case, you'd get in a traffic jam. And then as I was approaching the pub, it was an obvious thing to start drinking them. And that was that sense of getting into the pub, and if there were people at the bar that were in front of me, that madness of waiting, of having to wait for that pint, was horrific. And I'd always order 2 pints, always. The first one I'd drink straight away, and the second one I'd take with me to the table, and that was my drinking, and I became very good at it, and I was very proud of it. But in the end, my kidneys started to deteriorate, and the people I drank with started to deteriorate as well, and they started. I lost one of them; he died from wet brain, and that was horrific to watch. And then my best mate had a stroke and a heart attack, and he was 41 years old. And yet I never saw them as alcoholics, even though they drank from the moment they woke up. Incredible. It never occurred to me. Anyway, I left to come to New Zealand in the end, because I started blaming the British pub culture on my drinking, and I knew that I needed to do something about it. And I thought, go somewhere green and that's full of nature, and landed in Auckland, and that's where the problems really started, because I had no idea that my drinking would actually get on the plane with me and sit next to me, and the real the lack of structure when I hit Auckland, the fact that pubs stayed open until 5 in the morning, and it just became carnage. And in the end, my wife had enough, and off she went, and I began to realise that I was living without hope. I was accepting that that I had no control over my drinking at all, and it was horrific. It was horrific. It took me to some awful places. It covered me in shame, real shame. I did things that I felt terribly ashamed of, and it was so much against what I thought of myself as a person, against my morals and my ethics, and it was eroding me completely, emotionally and spiritually as a person, and physically. I was on my way out. My liver was nearly done, and I was lucky the day my ex-wife walked out. You know, that intolerant, unforgiving woman who I thought was obsessing about my alcohol, who I hated, the day she walked out, any structure that I'd got left, any hope I'd got left in my life, collapsed. It just went, and I knew I was in real trouble. In that one window of opportunity, I picked the phone up and I found the AA line. No idea what was going to happen, but I found it. And to my horror, they suggested someone came around that day and picked me up and took me to a meeting, which I was not expecting. And it took me by surprise. And when he put the phone down, I didn't have anyone to phone up to say, no, don't come around, which I would have done. And they turned up just a couple of hours later, and they weren't what I expected. I expected them to be drunk. I don't know why, but I expected them to be drunk. When he said, we'll send a couple of alkies around, I just thought, that's chaos for a start. You know? And they took me to a meeting, and at that first meeting, because I could not imagine life without alcohol. I just couldn't. I couldn't imagine any joy or any reason to keep living without booze. I just couldn't see anything. Everything I pictured in my life had alcohol in it. Every aspect of my life was about drinking. So the idea of giving up the thing that was absolutely at my core, at my centre, to me was horrific. But when I walked in those rooms and I heard people's stories, I realised that they'd been through what I'd been through, and that I wasn't, although I was different from most people, I wasn't different from everyone. And it was that sense that there were other people like me was enormously comforting. And what I saw in their eyes was a solution. And I realised I'd been living without hope, and that when you're in that state, that hopeless state, and you come out of it and look back at it, it's frightening. It's horrific. And I don't ever want to get back to that state again of feeling that I have no future. And it was that drove me to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I still have a fear of drinking. I'm 11 years now without a drink, and I still have a fear of it that's healthy enough to keep me away from that bottle. And I'm grateful for that, because I hear the stories in the rooms of the newcomers coming in and the carnage that's following their around their world. And it reminds me of the state I was in, the horrific hopelessness that I had. And I love AA. I mean, I struggle a little bit with the God thing, and I'm not going to pretend I don't, but for me, I do accept that I'm not the most powerful thing on the planet. And I also accept that the rooms for me have worked. So I can see higher power in that fellowship and in those rooms. And I love what AA gives me. It gives me a place to go on a Tuesday night when it's raining and there's nothing on TV and I'm feeling a bit lonely. It gives me a place to go when I'm overseas and I want some company. And I've been through some very difficult times with my daughter and my wife and my divorce and my mother dying, and AA's been there for all of those, and it's kept me on the straight and narrow, and for that I'm incredibly grateful. So I'm not ashamed anymore to be an alcoholic. You know, I had no choice, but I did have a choice about what I did with it, and what I've done with it is go to AA, and that solution for me has changed my life completely. I have a new life now. It took a while for things to settle down, but everything's turned around, and all those promises that were in that book that I was so cynical about at first have all come true. And I heard other people say that, and I thought, yeah, that's lucky for you. You're a lucky fella. But they have come through. You know, I've got a partner that's never seen me drink. She described me yesterday as the most dependable, solid man that she knew. And it took me by surprise, because even in my head, even after 11 years of sobriety, I still don't think of myself as solid and dependable. But I realise other people do, because I am. You know, I don't go to the coffee shop now and promise I'll be back in half an hour and stay there for 11 hours and come home reeking of coffee and cigarettes and lap dancing bars in between. I don't do that kind of stuff anymore. So my life's great. It's amazing. I wouldn't swap it. And I have no regrets. And there's no point anyway, you know, regretting what's happened. But I am grateful for what it's given me. And for that, you know, I feel passionate about AA. I feel passionate about my sobriety. And as they say, I've never met a grateful man who's a miserable man. And that's what the rooms have given me. Yeah, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. And just a reminder, you're listening to Access Radio, which broadcasts on 106.1 FM. And this is the Wellington Alcoholics Anonymous meeting on air. So if you or anyone you know has related to some of the sharing and would like to get in contact, Alcoholics Anonymous is all over the world, but in New Zealand, the helpline is 0800 229 6757. That's 0800 229 6757. So there is a sober alcoholic on the end of that line 24 hours a day. There's also the website aa.org.nz. That's where you can find this and other podcasts. Also a meetings list of all the meetings throughout the country. And we also have a Facebook page for this show. That's AA On Air Wellington on Facebook. So that's where we let you know when we're broadcasting. And feel free to send us a message. And now we'll ask Tanya to share, please.
Victoria, hi, my name's Tanya and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tanya.
And thanks for your short share, Matt. I related to your feelings more than anything else. And I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic, and I have been in these rooms for a few days, but I can still taste the dirt of where I came from. And for my story, I wasn't smart enough to get off the bus. I wasn't smart enough to get off the bus until I'd lost everything and everyone. And I like to start where I ended, and where I ended was in a one-bedroom nurse's home, old nurse's home, with a single bed, with no sheets on the bed, with a bucket in the corner, because I could no longer get up and go to the communal toilet to go for a wee. I could only make it to a bucket in the corner of my room. And that was my life for 3 days. I was on the sickness benefit, or the dole, or one of those benefits. And that's not enough money to stay drunk for as long as I needed to. What it did was keep me drunk for 3 days, and then I would detox in my single bed with no sheets on it, and sweat and shake and shiver until there was enough money back into my bank account from the dole, where I could walk down to Pack and Save at 12 o'clock in the morning and get my three-litre casks of wine, which I would then walk back a couple of miles, because I didn't have enough money for the bus, to drink in my room, to drink and throw up, drink and throw up, drink and throw up, until I passed out. And I did that for, I think, just over a year. And that was the stamina I had as an active alcoholic. And by that stage, I knew I was an alcoholic, but I was desperate for it to be anything else but alcohol, because the alcohol was the only thing that would take me out of myself. And so I clung on to it for years, but it didn't start that way. How it started was wine in nice glasses, and champagne in champagne glasses, and drinking with dinner, and drinking socially. But what happened for me was, when I had that first drink, I wanted more, and I wanted more than anybody else. And I didn't have an off button. That's what my friends described it as. Tanya just doesn't have an off button. And then what would happen for me was, I would go into blackout, and I was there functioning as a person, but I was not home at all. And I wouldn't have any recollection or memory of what I had done. And when I drank, my morals went with it, and my behaviour was so appalling, embarrassing, that the next day I would wake up probably 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. I would have such a brick on my chest of guilt and shame and remorse, of the little bits and pieces that would come flooding back to me, that the first thing I did was go to the fridge, because I had a fridge then, and get a bottle of wine or something bubbly and drink it. And that took it away again. And it just took it away. It took away the feelings. And I didn't have a clue that that was what I was doing. I was so baffled and confused by the position that I was in. And I functioned like that for a number of years. When the hair of the dog in the morning was explained to me, I thought, brilliant. And then I started having champagne breakfast with friends, with other people that would drink. You know, this was when it was all manageable for me. But it just became unmanageable when I was 28. That's when the wheels really started coming off for me. And I had also had a child during this period of time. I was a teenage pregnancy where I got pregnant under the influence, and I had a child, and that pregnancy kept me safe for a while. That child kept me safe for a while because I couldn't drink. I had to do certain things I couldn't drink. But as soon as he was older, then I had more flexibility and more freedom, and the job that I was in was paying more, and I was able to drink more, and I was able to do things more, and somehow that took me down such a slippery slope that I had no idea what was happening to me. All I knew was that things were starting to go. And those things that were starting to go were things like jobs weren't as easy to hold down. I started getting DICs. My first DIC was at 19, where I opened it. The policeman opened the door and I fell out of the car, just like some bad episode of Ab Fab. And that was, I was Patsy, you know, cigarette hanging out of my mouth, some kind of short ass skirt on, just a mess, thinking that it's a big joke. And that was at 19. Now that continued through to 30. That continued through, that behaviour continued through. And I managed to sustain it financially because of the career I had. I was able to have flashes of brilliance which would pay me commission checks. Ooh, those commission checks funded a lot of parties, and it kept me sick. But I started to lose jobs. I started to get DICs. I was moving all the time and dragging my child with me. I think he moved about 7 times in between the age of 3 and 10. I wasn't giving the right environment for him to thrive, and I was just, it was just a nightmare, and I was confused all the time. The only thing that was making me feel any better was being pissed. Was being pissed was the only thing that made me feel better. The wheels really came off for me when I'd relocated yet again to yet another country. I was in the middle of deepest, darkest Texas, where you don't ask people what you do for a job, they ask you what church you go to. I was vehemently opposed to any understanding of a God. I was brought up in an exceptionally atheist environment. Whilst my father didn't make any ruling about God, his view was that you children will not be indoctrinated into any religion until you're old enough to understand what it means, and then you can make your own choice. But it was very, very clear from his actions what he thought of a higher power or God. So I had no concept of it. I had no concept of what it meant. In my world, if it's to be, it's up to me. And there was nothing else. And failure wasn't an option. So I had no concept of a God at all. And the wheels were really coming off me. I was in Texas, deepest, darkest Texas. I met my first husband there. He was also an active alcoholic. He was from Northern England, so I felt at home with him because that's where my family's from. We got married, and then my relationship became so toxic, it was so violent and degrading, and my husband ended up in jail 3 times because he would be violent towards me, broke my ribs and that sort of thing. So, and I was incapable of getting myself out of this situation. My husband actually ended up calling my father in New Zealand and said, I can't do anything with her. You need to bring her home. And my parents brought me home. I stayed with them for a bit, and then I went back out again. And I had no idea that it was alcohol. I had no idea that if I stopped drinking, things would be different. They'd always been that way. Why would it be any different? I'd been to a couple of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. They kept saying God this and God that. And I remember hearing that unless you invite God into your life, you won't have a chance. And I thought, well, that's me. That's me screwed. Then that won't work. But what happened for me is all the choices went away. I became unsalvageable, I think, because I couldn't help myself. I didn't believe in God. I didn't believe in anything else that could help me. And I remember the final kind of moment for me was that I was lying face down on my single bed with no sheets on it in this nurse's home with no money and cigarette holes in the carpet because I'd put cigarettes in there. And I was starting to have a hallucination where there was this being on my back shaking me, and it had its fingers around my neck and it was squeezing, and I was awake, but I couldn't stop this. I knew that now my mind was starting to go and my brain was starting to go, and I was terrified. And at that point in time, I prayed to a God that I didn't understand and said, please, please help me. I'm getting a bit emotional because it's just like I don't really live in that moment, but I remember that moment and I feel exactly the same way that I felt at that point in time, in that moment. The desperation, the confusion, the how the hell did I end up in this space where I've got this imaginary demon on my neck trying to choke me. And I prayed to a God, and you know what? Things changed almost immediately. I reached out again to an alcoholic, and they took me to a doctor, and the doctor gave me a recommendation. I got into the Bridge program. I went into the Bridge program drunk because I managed to find some wine that I'd hidden from myself under my single bed that had no furniture in the room, but I'd hidden it from myself, and it was ooh. But you know what? That got me in the doors, and once I got in there, I detoxed under a medical care, and I surrendered to this thing, whatever it was that I didn't understand. I didn't really believe I was an alcoholic, because an alcoholic, like Matt said, was some guy in a brown, you know, coat and drinking in the park, and you know, well, I was worse than that, but I still wasn't an alcoholic, because an alcoholic was this really bad person. I didn't take drugs, and I didn't break the law, and except for when I drove drunk and picked my son up drunk and all that kind of stuff. So it was really, really confusing. But when I got into this program, I was so humble and so broken that the only way was to be fixed. And I accepted every suggestion that was given to me in this program that I honestly thought it was a bunch of bollocks, what a bunch of bollocks sitting around in a room talking about your shit, you know? How's that going to help me? The promises in the big book meant nothing to me because, you know what, I just wanted to wake up in the morning and not want to die. That's all I wanted. I wanted to know whether it was 4 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the afternoon without ringing somebody to ask. I had a very low expectation of what life could be like without alcohol. I thought I'd absolutely shot myself in my foot. For my career, I'd done some spectacularly embarrassing and public events that I only really remembered parts of. So I still cringe to this day. And things got better really quickly. Just to show how much better they got and how quickly they got. I came into the program, I was unemployed, unemployable, living in that, oh my God, horrible place, with all the things that went with it. I was in rehab. I went into rehab on the 2nd of August, I came out on the 2nd of October. By the 17th of November, I was employed again in a six-figure salary, in a job that I used to do with full knowledge of who I was. And my world just I put into my will, I took the steps that I didn't really understand, that I went through with a sponsor who very carefully and lovingly took me through them and knew that I didn't understand, and I applied them to my life, and I do apply them to my life today. And for me today, my world's a completely different place. The child that I dragged through my misery is, I have a loving, trusted relationship with. As Matt said before, you know, come the 2nd of August this year, I'll be 14 years sober. And in those 14 years, one day at a time, by the grace of God, in those 14 years, I have followed through with absolutely everything I've committed to do. I have not told an untruth. Maybe a little, you know, like maybe some fudging there, but you know, like no. I have not had to repair something. I have lovingly seen my father to the next world, and I didn't like my father. I loved my father, but man, I did not like him, and I left home at 15 for a reason. But yet, I suited up, and I've showed up, and I've done the right thing, and to the best of my ability, because it's written out for me, and I feel better when I do that. When I move away from the program, I feel like shit, or I feel bad or guilty, or something doesn't go wrong. For me, the framework of the steps and the program has not saved my life. It has given me a life, and it's given a life to those people around me that cared about me, because I caused so much pain and so much chaos. But at the end of it, I have some peace, because now I realize that I wasn't this horrible person that I thought I was. I was powerless and addicted to a substance that made me change the way that I am. And without it, and with the help of this program, I have some peace and serenity and joy in my life. And it's a good life to be in. And I no longer wake up in the morning / dusk / whatever time it is in a sweat because of the guilt of what I may or may not have done the night before. I no longer sleep with my friends' husbands or boyfriends because I didn't really know I was doing it at the time. And it's really hard to explain to someone the next day what I did. Really? No. You know, like, because they really think that you're active in this activity. And I wasn't. The lights are on in Nobi's home. Well, the lights are on today. And I feel that I would be died dead, you know, not just having a shit life. I would be dead if it wasn't for this program. And I'm really grateful for this opportunity to share, and I'm really grateful for the people that make this opportunity available and do the service here. So thank you for the opportunity to share, and thank you for being there for me.
Thanks, Tanya. So just a reminder, you're listening to Access Radio. We're broadcasting on 106.1 FM, and this is the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting on air. Once again, if you or anyone you know relates to what you've heard today and want to get in touch, the New Zealand helpline is 0800 229 6757. That's 0800 229 6757. Additionally, meetings in New Zealand and all other countries you can find on the website online. The New Zealand site is aa.org.nz. Right, we've got another 5 minutes. Do you want to share?
I'm Dan, I'm an alcoholic.
How you doing?
And, I love being at this meeting because, it's certainly powerful stuff, you know, and it's amazing how much I sit here and just relate to to what I hear, and it just reminds me that I'm definitely in the right place. And I think I came in at the right time for me. I could have come in earlier. I had my opportunities. I drank very chaotically as a teenager. I certainly relate to the, like, why isn't everyone else getting as much enjoyment out of this as me? And and I couldn't understand why I'd be the one getting into trouble all the time with my friends, and they were drinking the same as me. I don't think they were drinking the same as me at all. And there was a reason why I was just getting in all the strife. But it ended up in me getting into quite a bit of trouble, and I ended up coming to the rooms of AA at the age of 20, and I listened to what I heard, and it kind of scared me a bit, because I thought I might be one of these people. But there's no way I wanted to hang around and find out, so I didn't. And but luckily, what it did is it sowed the seed for later on. And so I drank through my 20s and most of my, well, about half my 30s, and caught myself at a weak moment on a Sunday morning and rang up that 0800 number that Victoria read out before, and ended up at another meeting of AA. And yeah, that was just over 7 years ago. And haven't had a drink since then, which is, you know, like I went from the day before pouring this poison down my throat with absolute abandon, but, you know, it's almost like I knew it was coming to an end, because it was like that last night I couldn't get the drinks down me quick enough, and I was ordering drinks two at a time, because it was just like, it was like somehow I knew it was the last night, and like, and I hope it was the last night, but, you know, like, because it's, I can't be sure, and I haven't, you know, promised myself or anyone else that I'll never drink again. But this, you know, even though it's you know, that's my hope. But I realise it's a daily program, and so I need to do today what I did yesterday to keep me sober. And you know, I can't say what's going to happen tomorrow, but all I can do is focus on what I need to focus on today. But yeah, but my since coming to AA, I've done the things that have been suggested. You know, like the first thing they said to me was keep coming back. So I did. You know, the early days I'd drag myself to meetings even when I didn't really want to go, and sometimes I'd be skipping and jumping to meetings because I couldn't wait to get there. But that wasn't always the case. But I got through the, you know, I found some meetings in my area that I liked and kept going to those ones. I went to some I didn't quite like, so I didn't go to those ones. But luckily, in a place like Wellington, there's 60-odd meetings a week in the Wellington region, so I had a lot of choice. So I've kept going to those meetings, and I heard get a sponsor and start working on the steps. And so eventually, I got a sponsor and started working on the steps. And that's but you know, and it's been like a gradual process, and the result of doing those things, those simple things, and you know, I do other things, like I do a bit of service here and there and try and help others, you know, having worked through the steps, and I continue to work through the steps, but enables me to help other people now, and so I can sit with someone else that's new and help them through the steps and basically pass on what I was given. And that's the only thing I need to do, really, like, you know, stay sober myself and help other people. And so now I kind of incorporate AA into my life. I've got a life now. I've got things which I wouldn't have imagined having when I was drinking. I've got them now, you know. And not, I'm not talking about material things. Some of them are material things, but, you know, those aren't necessarily important. But, yeah, I wake up every morning and I'm not thinking, you know.
That program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Thanks, New Zealand On Air, for funding the Access Internet Radio Project.